2018, somewhere around 2:35 p.m., hearing room B. We'll go to an organizational meeting, adoption of committee rules. Co-chair, co-tech, do you have a motion on the adoption of committee rules, please?
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the rules for the Legislative Council Committee. Welcome, everyone.
Discussion on the motion. Any objections to the motion? The motion carries. We'll now go to a work session. I'd like to open a work session on filing amicus brief. And with that, I will ask Dexter Johnson, please, to come forward and explain this significant work session, as well as to, then I will go to, I think, somewhere I'm going to go to you, Brian Boquist, as well in this little issue. But I want to hear from Legislative Council to explain what exactly we're doing here, because we will be asking for an approval.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And the materials that you have include a amicus brief concerning a lawsuit that was filed challenging certain aspects of the 2017 transportation funding legislation. Certain members of the Legislative Assembly expressed an interest in filing a brief that would set forth the legislature's position on this case. For Legislative Council to be able to do so, we need your authorization under ORS 173.135 before we can actually appear in the proceeding. So that's what we are asking you to do today. And I'd like to ask Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel Alan Dale to come up to briefly explain the contents of the brief and answer any questions you may have on it before you take this action.
Counsel Dale, proceed.
Chairs Courtney and COTEC, members of the committee, my name is Alan Dale, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was the drafter of the privilege tax at issue in the case and also of the amicus brief. So I'm not sure how much detail you want. Do you want me to describe what the case is about and the position?
Well, Counsel, why don't you proceed? This is a significant action that we're being asked to take, so I do think you should put something on the record to explain for the record as well of all of us exactly what's going on, because I'm not convinced everyone at the committee here is fully conversant. I think Senator Boquist, I know, is, and there may be other members, but I have a feeling a lot are not. So why don't you proceed?
That's fine. I'm prepared to do that. So the case is AAA Idaho Oregon Auto Source LLC v. State. It's about Article 9, Section 3A of the Oregon Constitution, which generally provides a description of certain tax revenues and limits the use of those revenues to construction and maintenance of highways. Mm-hmm. The specific provision is subsection 1B, which describes any tax or excise levied on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles. And the question is whether that describes the privilege tax that was enacted as part of House Bill 2017 in the last session. The privilege tax is a tax imposed on motor vehicle dealers for the privilege of engaging in the business of selling new motor vehicles at retail in this state. And so the question is whether the privilege tax is a tax on the ownership, operation, or use of motor vehicles. Now, nobody has argued that it is a tax on the operation or use of motor vehicles, so it's really a question of whether it's a tax on the ownership of motor vehicles. And furthermore, AAA, the petitioners in this case, have not argued that it is a tax on the ownership altogether of motor vehicles, but on an incident of ownership. That is the right to dispose of property that you own, so the right to sell the motor vehicle. And our office feels strongly that that is not correct, that on is a narrow preposition, on means on, and that a tax on the ownership of a motor vehicle would be a tax that you owe simply by virtue of owning the motor vehicle. So it would be a registration fee, a title fee, a personal property tax, say, for instance. And it can be readily shown, we feel, that the privilege tax is not a tax on the ownership per se of motor vehicles, because it's measured by the retail sales price of the motor vehicle, which means that a dealer that, you know, owns 1,000 vehicles but doesn't sell any in a reporting period doesn't owe any privilege tax. So it's not a tax on the ownership per se. So obviously parties disagree, and the Joint Committee on Transportation Preservation and Modernization knew that there were stakeholders that didn't agree with this analysis, and so they provided for expedited review of this sole question to the Oregon Supreme Court. The advantage of expedited review is that a tax challenge can take up to 5 years to work its way through the court system to the Supreme Court. And there are two cases of expedited review of questions under Article 9, Section 3A. And they took 18 months from the effective date of the challenge bill to the final decision of the Oregon Supreme Court. So it's a time saver. House Bill 2017 also provided that in the event the Supreme Court determines that the privilege tax is described by Article 9, Section 3A, the privilege tax and the compensatory use tax would both be repealed. Furthermore, it required an aggrieved party to file a petition for review within 30 days of the effective date of House Bill 2017, and AAA and the Oregon Truckers Association did that, and it's at that point that members of the Joint Transportation Committee asked our office to file an amicus brief in the case. And the reason they did, I think, is that the we had been giving opinions on this subject to the committee, to individual members, to LRO, written, oral, informal, formal opinions for something like 18 months at that point. So we wanted to make sure that the opinions that the arguments that we'd made to them and that apparently had convinced them were before the Supreme Court when they made their determination. So in this case, the respondent state of Oregon is defended by the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice had 2 months then to research, write, and file their response brief. And so in comparing the response brief, which was filed last week, with the amicus brief, I would say that the amicus brief can add value in two ways, principal ways. One is that precisely because they had 2 months to work on this issue, and we've been at it almost 2 years at this point, that there's no contradiction between the response brief and the amicus brief. There's considerable overlap. Where there is overlap, I think that the amicus brief has more nuance and detail just because we've been thinking about it longer. And then there is, in addition, another line of argumentation that appears in the amicus brief and not in the response brief, and I think it would be useful for the Supreme Court to have that in front of it when making their determination.
Questions? Senator Brokus?
I have a question down there first, I think.
Well, I could.
Yeah, question versus statement. I have a statement. Whatever you want to do, Mr. Chair.
I have a question.
Just a minute. I'm just going to collect my thoughts here.
Representative McClain.
Thank you, President Courtney. Forgive me if this has been asked before because I arrived late and I apologize. What is the history with regards to amicus briefs being filed by the Legislative Assembly? In this regard, have we done it before? And generally speaking, how many times has the Legislative Assembly filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court on regard of, and specifically when with regards to legislative intent of language we passed?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative McClain, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, I'll answer that question. During my tenure as Legislative Counsel, which began in late 2007, we have filed one other amicus brief, and that was with respect to the Capitol Steps protester case, where the policy of the Legislative Assembly was to not allow protesters to be present on the steps 24/7. There were individuals that wanted to protest 24/7 on the steps, and they were trespassed from that, and then they challenged the constitutionality of that.
Can I add something? Also,
sure.
Chairs Courtney and Kotuk, Representative McClain, actually the legislative intent behind House Bill 2017 isn't at issue in the case. So it's the application of Article 9, Section 3A, which was adopted by the people in 1942 as a constitutional amendment. So it's an interpretation of the intent of the people in 1942 as applied to the privilege tax.
May I follow up?
May I just add just one other thing, and that is that prior to, it's my recollection that Legislative Council has also appeared in two other proceedings when Greg Chamoff was Legislative Council, and I'm not sure about before that. So there is some precedent.
Keep going.
Thank you, President Courtney. Therefore, we've done it at least once. In the instance on the protests within the scope of what's time, place, manner, reasonableness, in essence, was our amicus advocacy as a property owner that was seeking to have a certain amount of security on a building that we are responsible for, as opposed to an advocate?
Co-chairs, Representative McLean. It was the provision at issue was an LAC rule, so in that sense it wasn't a statute that was in question. It was a rule adopted by the Legislative Administration Committee concerning building use. So it was a legislative act that was part of the what was at issue in the case, but it was not a statute like is being considered here.
And we nevertheless were seeking to have an interpretation upheld, which was the Legislative Assembly's prerogative as owner of the building where protests were taking place.
Yes, that's true, although there also was a collateral issue about the extent to which legislators had immunity from being subpoenaed to testify and proceeding concerning the legislative action taken. So that was a collateral issue as well, and that was a constitutional issue.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, President Courtney. Alan, you actually spoke to this a moment ago in response to, I think, a question from Representative McLean, and that was that you did not see the legislative interpretation of House Bill 2017 as being at issue in this controversy, rather just simply the application of Article 9. Is that what you said?
Co-Chairs Courtney and Kotek, Representative Vile, yes.
I'm curious about that. If that's true, then it seems like a DOJ brief would probably be enough. I'm inclined to support the idea of having an amicus brief come from the legislature, but you cite PGE versus Boley and really kind of hone in on this is an easy question because the language is the language and Article 9 going clear back to 1942 is clear. But it seems to me that if we're going to weigh in as a legislature, that really using a Gaines type of analysis might not be a bad idea for us to really give the court some help in determining why we did what we did. And I know that your opinions as we led up to the adoption of House Bill 2017 didn't deal a lot with that, but I think the nature of that big transportation package and what we were trying to accomplish and why this piece was included in there could be very instructive for the court. And obviously DOJ, I haven't seen DOJ's brief, but I'm dubious that DOJ's done a Gaines type analysis and probably just stuck to a PGE versus Boley analysis.
Well, let me see. There's a lot there. House Bill 2017 itself states that the intent of the legislature is that Article 9, Section 3A does not apply to the privilege tax, which, of course, is legally non-binding. But
it's maybe legally non-binding, but I think that's, in the last few years, Gaines has really kind of taken a different approach to what PGE Boley said as the black letter.
Right, but the thing is, where the history gets into, and this actually is the line of argumentation that is in the amicus brief, is the history of the 1942 amendment. And that's where the amicus brief really kind of crosses swords with the AAA, the petitioner's brief. And it's a question of... do you want me to explain this part?
You're probably going to have to, because we've started to get down a road. It's getting dangerous in terms of the record. So, counsel, you probably should.
So what happens, the petitioners have proposed a test for making this determination. And the test runs like this, which is that when the... legislature imposes a new tax related to motor vehicles, you look at the motor vehicle code as in effect in 1942. If there's a similar tax to the new tax, and the revenue from that 1942 tax went into the state highway fund, then revenue from the new tax is subject to Article 9, Section 3A. And the petitioners cite as their gotcha statute, what is a registration fee? It's a fee owed by all vehicle owners by virtue of owning their cars and before they can operate them on the public highways. So you've got ownership and operation right there in that registration fee, and it applies, it reaches motor vehicle dealers as a subcategory of vehicle owners. And the problem with this, the revenue did go into the state highway fund, but the problem with this is that's not like the privilege tax. And so I read the 1940 vehicle code and found instead a license fee that was imposed only on motor vehicle dealers, and it's more regulatory than revenue raising. So that's a difference from the privilege tax, but it applies only to motor vehicle dealers, and payment of the license fee authorizes them to engage in the business of selling motor vehicles. So it's much more similar to the privilege tax than the one proposed by the petitioners. And then I looked at the financial statements at the back of Oregon Laws 1941, and it's itemized. And so you can see that the registration fee and the license fee both went into the general fund, and the registration fee, the petitioner's site, was then transferred to the state highway fund, but the license fee, which is like the privilege tax, was not. It remained in the general fund. And so if you're under the analysis of the history of Article 9, Section 3A, the petitioners propose a test, and under the analysis added by the amicus brief, I feel that even if the court adopts their test, petitioners lose under their own test.
Follow up. Thank you, President Courtney. So I appreciate that background, and I'm not trying to second guess the brief, but I'm trying to suggest that strict black letter read only the language of the legislation test that is articulated in PGE versus Boley really has been expanded by Gaines to ask the question when it needs to be asked what the legislative intent was, and I'm suggesting that we may want to take advantage of that here.
I would say, Representative Vile, that that is in there, and it is it is mentioned that the legislature wanted the privilege tax specifically as a stream of revenue that would not be subject to Article 9, Section 3A.
Thanks.
Further questions?
Part of the package. Sorry.
Do you want to make a statement now, Senate Bill question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, colleagues. And I note that most everybody at this diocese is not like us. They're all lawyers, and so I've intriguedly listen to this, and that is exactly the point that was raised, I think, by several representatives, is the four co-chairs unfortunately spent an unduly amount of time locked in the dungeon of this building, some 18 months, and we probably spent weeks of entire time on this sole subject of what is the interpretation, and every member of the Joint Committee and virtually, I think, all members of the legislature saw these legal opinions of
what does this say? Were this a normal piece of legislation that I could certainly lose my seat over with my colleague to the left? But instead, this is probably in the 12 years I've been here, the longest amount of time I've ever spent on a single piece of legislature, far more time than I've spent in a bipartisan nature in any one room. And so we're at this point where the four co-chairs and vice chairs looked at this and said, this is really the legal advice we've gotten has been the same from the beginning to the end of this 18-month period. All the members have gotten the same, whether you voted yes or no on the bill. And the importance of that is after 18 months of work and going through here, and the fact that there is a dispute, and there is even a dispute on, if you could say there's two sides, both sides have split disputes on, or disputes of cases themselves for you lawyers, that's how you'll make this money. So the four co-chairs were very simple. We wanted to ensure that the Supreme Court, and for the benefit of the legislature, because there's only one shot at this, and if it's going to be struck down or upheld, we need to know earlier, that what we, the legislature, was told in the joint committee, in the leadership, and all of the members was transmitted to those fine men and women in the Supreme Court so that they knew exactly what we were told and why we made the decision. It doesn't mean whether you agree or disagree, but that is what we wanted conveyed, since this is, once again, the largest piece of legislation and the most time-committed piece of legislation I've seen in the 12 years I've been in this building. So that's why, and I'm speaking for Senator Beyer on the Senate half, I don't presume to speak for my colleagues on the House half, but I do know that all four members, the chair and the vice chair, put forward and said, yes, we should put forth a brief so that very clearly is articulated to the Supreme Court what we were told and what we thought. That's why we asked for it. That's why it's before you. That's why I'm here for the first time in 9 years, because I missed the last meeting 4 years ago. So,
Co-Chair, your motion on the adoption of filing the amicus brief, please.
Chair Courtney, I move to approve the filing by Legislative Council of an amicus brief in the case of AAA Oregon Idaho LLC versus State of Oregon.
Motion before us. Any further discussion? Representative McLean.
Thank you, President Courtney. I'm going to vote no today. To a certain extent because of the reasons articulated by my colleague, Senator Boquist, that I reach a different conclusion. The Constitution of the State of Oregon provides for separate but equal powers. It is highly unusual for the legislative branch to come before the judicial branch and articulate what it heard, perceived, or thought when it drafted legislation. It's the job of the executive branch to defend legislation, not the legislative branch. I'm troubled that the ends, while perhaps admirable, may justify the means in this regard and open the door into an extraordinary extension of conduct by our legislative branch. The balanced tripart constitutional authority has worked, and it may work ugly and at time a great length, but it nevertheless is the best form of government that I believe the world has seen, and we are just simply one part of that, but we have three separate branches. And I just think it is not the place of the legislative branch to go before the Supreme Court of the State of Oregon and during an active case sought by our citizens and to articulate why we made that decision. There is a record. There are legislative records. There are hearing notes. There are floor speeches. All the basis of legislative intent, and even if the amicus brief could be confined in its interpretation, which I believe Representative Vile may disagree with, confined in its interpretation to simply be a commentary on what the citizens thought of in 1942 in a constitutional provision. It is still extraordinary that the legislative branch stand in the Supreme Court and weigh in. I voted for the transportation bill, supported the process So I'm not here to relitigate that vote. I just simply am a traditionalist when good government has served us well, and I'm just surprised. And in fact, the answer, I think, of previous amicus told me enough that there has not been, that we were in a different role at the time, trying to uphold our ability to control what goes on in this building. So for those reasons, I'm going to vote no today, and I do so acknowledging the great work you've done and the hard work you've done. I just, out of a matter of principle, do not believe your good work should be submitted to the Supreme Court to influence their decision. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Pozanski, please.
Thank you, Mr. President. In line with what Representative McClain has said, is basically the reasons why I am supporting this. I think it is very important for us who actually have taken the time to pass the legislation with the deliberations to make certain in these few and far cases that we have actually done an amicus curiae brief to basically make certain that we speak for ourselves and that they understand why we have taken the position we have and what our intent was. Clearly, all we're doing is giving them, if anything, additional information or supplemental information that they can get from the record, but at least it makes it very clear. So when they make their ruling, which will be independent as the separation of powers and the judicial branch, they will actually have heard from us, and they can say, well, that might be what you meant, but we read these words differently and the interpretation differently. But at least it will be very clear as to where we as a body stood. And I think it is also remarkable. I was trying to think prior to Mr. Chamoff being in charge of Legislative Council, Tom
Clifford.
I believe there's at least one or two times that I know of that we actually have had some type of engagement. At least that's what I remember. Of course, that's been many years ago, so I may be wrong on that statement. But I do believe, and it does show that we are not doing this on a current, regular basis. But this is one of those situations that I believe that is appropriate, and I will be supporting the motion. Thank you, Mr. President.
Further discussion? Representative Isle.
I just want to reinforce the fact that I am voting in favor of this for the same reasons I think that Senator Pozanski just articulated. And I don't think that we necessarily need to simply rely on DOJ to articulate our positions when we are arguing for or against something before that third branch, the judicial branch. So I'm going to respectfully disagree with my esteemed colleague, Representative McClain, and act in support of this. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Senator Pozanski.
Yeah, and just to follow up with what the Representative Isle just said, when you look at the title on this, the state of Oregon buying through the Department of Revenue, to me, that's where DOJ is coming in, and what they're doing is representing that agency. Clearly, I think that it is appropriate for us to be able to make certain the record is clear as to what our intent was, and then the courts can tell us whether we got it right or we got it wrong.
Representative McClain.
Thank you. And colleagues, in my no vote today, just want to emphasize it's an extraordinary act for the legislative branch to stand in a forum and tell the judicial branch what we thought. That's not our job. And I would also say that if you can do it here, then where are the restraints? Why aren't we doing it in every case? Why aren't we articulating? Why don't we go into the judicial branch every single time they want to know legislative intent and give our an opine to them what we thought? It's extraordinary because it is, frankly, improper. The legislative branch makes the laws, and we do not go in the judicial branch and tell them what we thought. They look at a legislative record. This is a separation of power principled argument. I respect that it's not the opinion of those here, but I would say as you vote yes, you might think, when will you ever say no when it comes up again? Thank you.
The clerk.
Mr. Chair, I just quickly, because this is not a precedent. I just need to put that on the record that this is not a first. That the legislature has joined an amicus brief. So I need to state that that has happened in the past, and I will be an aye vote.
And Mr. President, I also
want to
just clarify that this is not just talking about legislative, our intent. It's analyzing the constitutional amendment. And I think it's very appropriate that we share the results of our research into that constitutional amendment and the impact that it had on this decision. So I feel very comfortable with my yes vote.
Clerk, would you please call the roll?
Senator Brzozinski?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Senator Boquist?
Yes.
Representative Vial?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Representative Williamson?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
No.
Co-Chair Kotek?
Aye.
Co-Chair Courtney?
Yes. The motion to file the amicus brief has been approved. We'll close the work session and go to a public hearing and work session on policies to implement the 2017 public records legislation. I think I'll leave it at that because we're going to talk about four items, two of which we're going to seek approval of and two of which we're just going to have a discussion. So are you going to outline those policies or do you want me to at least say what the policies are by number?
Mr. Chair, I was going to outline. It's up to you.
All right. Well, as I understand it, the policies are 142-109, policy 142-110. Those two, we will seek the adoption of those two policies. Policy 142-111 and 142-112, we simply will discuss, and there will be at least two other items we will discuss. We will not seek votes on those. Did I say it correctly, counsel?
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, you did.
Okay. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. First, let me begin by just explaining what these policy documents are. And these are infrequent situations where the office asks you formally to establish a particular direction for the office, typically involving office procedures of one kind or another. And all of these policies are... have some basis in what our office procedures are going to be. The 2017 legislature made some far-reaching changes in public records procedures. I talked some about those at yesterday's training, but these policies will help you to comply with those requirements in particularly two areas. The first is the compression of time frames by which the legislature and all other public bodies need to respond to public records. And then the second is this open government impact statement concept that was first put forth in the 2017 legislation. So with that background, what I'd like to do is turn first to policy 142-109, and I'll talk a little bit about what that is, but essentially it is driven by the new requirement that a public body must acknowledge a public records request within 5 business days, and that's a very short period of time. As it's certainly been our experience that public records requests made of the legislature come in to all kinds of different offices, to each of your offices individually. Certainly a lot of them come directly to Legislative Council. Some come to LAC, and some come to other individual, either staff members or really throughout the building. It is certainly foreseeable that those records may not be picked up on by whoever receives them during a 5-day period. And so this policy is designed to be an official document whereby if somebody does not file their request with Legislative Council, then it is a reason to explain to the individual that the requester why the branch didn't meet its 5-day timeline for acknowledging the request. And if the acknowledgement isn't met in 5 days, in theory, that is the statute treats that as a denial of the request, which is much more problematic. So this policy will basically, while it won't require requesters, they're going to do what they're going to do, it will say that the 5-day time frame doesn't begin until legislative council is made aware of the request, either by them filing it in the appropriate address or by us learning of it from whoever has received it. That's the principal thing that this policy is designed to do. It does provide, does request that if someone is seeking a fee waiver, that they provide additional information. I'm going to talk more about fee waivers later, but basically in order to determine whether there's a basis for waiving a fee, certain information is needed, and that information is set forth in this policy. Finally, the only other significant change, a lot of the language simply mirrors what the existing law is now, but there is a final element that is a little bit different. It provides that multiple similar requests made to different offices by the same requester can be treated as a single request. And this is also largely for purposes of determining the fees and whether they are, say, 90 small fees or a single larger fee. And this would authorize legislative council to be able to treat those as a single request.
So that is 109?
That is 109.
All right. So let us deal with these separately, because I don't want to commingle them, because I think it'll cause confusion. So he has spoken to 142-109, which I will ask the co-chair at the appropriate time for a motion to adopt. But is there any discussion on what has just been presented by Legislative Council on 142-109? Co-chair, co-tech, please.
Chair Courtney, I move to adopt Legislative Council Committee Policy Number 142-109, dated January 10th, 2018.
Any more discussion? Is there any objections? Motion has passed. Thank you. Please proceed now, I guess, to 142-110. Is that right?
Mr. Co-chair, that is correct.
Please.
Okay, 142-110. addresses this new document that the 2017 legislation asked legislative council to prepare for each bill, and that is called in the legislation an open government impact statement. And this basically just sets forth what a statement would look like and incorporates the statutory standards for what it must reflect, which is first, whether a particular measure varies from or conforms with legislative council drafting standards for a measure that modifies exemptions or public records, the scope of public records. And second, whether in legislative council's opinion it the measure would modify the existing standards of transparency that exist in the existing law. So if those things occur, then, and we've attached two examples to this policy, then the impact statement would identify how the transparency standards are changed. And then we have also attached a second example, which is what the statement would look like if, you know, our conclusion is that the standards have not changed. It's important that the committee act with respect to adopting this standard, because the legislation is in effect right now and bills are being prepared this is a little bit goes beyond what is required by the legislation. The legislation requires impact statements to be prepared when a committee moves a bill out of committee to the floor, in either chamber. This bill, actually, Legislative Council staff, Cameron Miles is here, who will mainly do this, will prepare impact statements for all measures and then update them if they are engrossed. So those will appear in OLIS and will also be transmitted to another entity created by the 2017 legislation, the Sunshine Committee, which is an executive branch entity.
Council has just completed a presentation on 142-110. Any discussion? Representative Isle.
Thank you, President Courtney. Is this going to require expanding your bandwidth to be able to get this done, or is this something you see possible within the confines of your current staffing?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Vile, the 2017 legislation, we asked in our appropriation bill for a policy option package if that measure passed, and that was granted by the Ways and Means Committee. So there is current funding for that.
Thank you.
For discussion, Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I clearly grasped the part about transparency because I'm looking out the window and it's sunshining. Could maybe counsel give an example, because I have no idea what he just said. I mean, is there an example of what you're talking about here? I mean, yeah, it's transparency, but I don't quite. What's transparency between what we do now and what we didn't do before? Can you maybe give a real-world example of what this impact is?
Sure. Co-Chair, Senator Boquist. Let's say there is, well, I'll cite an existing exemption from mandatory public records disclosure for documents that constitute internal advisory communication. Let's say there was a measure before you that repealed that exemption. We would prepare a open government impact statement that would describe what that change would look like. Alternatively, let's say there was a particular kind of report that was filed, was required to be filed, say, with the Department of Administrative Services, and a measure was before you that would exempt that from the mandatory disclosure. This impact statement would flag for you that this is making those reports no longer be available, or at least not required to be made available.
Quick follow-up, Mr.
Sure.
I mean, so I'm assuming the intent here, I don't remember this from the floor, the intent here is we have a staff measure summary and a bill that just told us everything you just told us, but we're now going to have another statement that says, hey, everybody, do remember that these things are going to change and you won't be able to see them anymore, or whatever that is. Is that sort of, the sunshine is putting light on something that's already in the staff measure summary and already in the bill. Is that a correct statement? Is that sort of what we're doing here?
Co-chairs, Senator Boquist, the policy concern with the 2017 legislation was that there's more than 100 exemptions, and they tend to sometimes appear and are created indirectly by the legislature. The legislature will act on a bill, and one line of it will say this kind of report is confidential, but it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of legislative attention that the parties that supported the 2017 legislation would want. So I think that's the
thank
goal.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you.
Co-Chair, Kotek, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just I'm a little worried about workload. I understand you had additional resources, but, you know, we could have a session where you have a lot of bills where you actually need to write pretty in-depth impact statements, for example. But yet, in this, you're saying you're going to do an impact statement for every single bill introduced? And what's your time frame on that? I mean, because as you mentioned, the legislation said we will do it when the bills, you know, have movement, which is when we do fiscal statements and revenue statements, and which, you know, this is, we do thousands of bills. So what I'm worried about a little bit, you set this standard, and then halfway through the long session, you're like, that's a lot of work. You can't change what you put in. I'm just trying to understand if you thought that through. I'm just a little concerned about doing every bill because a good number of bills are never going to have any impact statement at all. But you still have to generate them. You have to post them, you know. So.
Madam Co-Chair, it is a good thing that this is a short session, that we're experimenting with this. And if it does, in fact, prove to be, in our estimate, a little bit more overwhelming, we'll be back here amending this policy, for one thing. But because unlike LFO and LRO, we're not in committees every day. So we are less aware of what particular action a committee is doing than they may be. And so in order to ensure that the impact statement is available when a committee decides to act, we are being proactive here and preparing them when the bill is introduced. And most of the time, we believe it's going to be a very simple no-impact statement, and it's, that will be a, you know, a macro form kind of thing, and will not take time to generate.
Just a follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. Just to clarify, so in terms of the tracking of this, you know, that moment when it seems that you have to do a statement, is this is an easier way of managing workflow. Just do it when the thing's introduced, and if it's needed and if it has to be amended, then you'll deal with it later. But is that the thinking?
Madam Co-Chair, yes, that is the thinking.
Okay.
And I will also note that these impact statements, unlike the revenue and fiscal impact statements, where a committee has to have them before it can move the bill, these impact statements aren't subject to that requirement. So they just have to be out there on OLIS.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks for the clarification.
Any further discussion? Co-Chair, protect your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Courtney, I move to adopt Legislative Council Committee Policy Number 142-110, dated January 10th, 2018.
Any further discussion? Any objections? The motion to adopt 142-110 has been adopted. How do you want to proceed in the remaining materials, since we're not asking for a motion? Do you want to talk about them all, or do you want to separate them out? How do you want to proceed?
Mr. Chair, let me briefly summarize these materials. I know we're running short on time, and I think there's sufficient enough public interest that they should probably be acted upon later.
Now, as I understand it, you deal on 142-111, 142-112, but then you also gave me a sheet of other two items that you're going to...
Just briefly, if time permits, I will talk about them as well. The 2017 legislation created a directed the Legislative Council Committee to form a subcommittee for public records, and that subcommittee is in the process of being formed, and I think that might be the forum where these matters are discussed as well. But I'm just really getting this out there. The first is 111. The legislation that created the Open Government Impact Statement said that that the statement must identify if a particular measure varies from drafting standards that legislative council may adopt with respect to public records. And to be candid, we have drafting standards that apply to all legislation. I believe that is not what was intended by that requirement. We don't have specific public records drafting public records exemption drafting legislation. This policy proposes four standards that would apply. It's quite straightforward, as you can read. And so if that would be the interest of the committee, we could adopt those. Again, the legislation requires an impact statement to identify if standards are not met in a particular measure, but it doesn't actually require those standards. So that is what Policy 111 is.
Yep.
Moving on to Policy 112, the current, as I mentioned, the 2017 legislation compressed timeframes for responses, and the most significant of those compressions is basically giving a public body a mere 15 days to either produce records, claim exemptions, or provide a written statement that they needed more time and an estimate of when they could complete the request. One of the things that is existing practice right now is that is very time-consuming is how fees are computed for these requests. Right now, the legal standard is that a public body can recoup its actual costs, and that hasn't changed. Right now, what happens, though, is when a request comes in, we identify who's going to be working on this in terms of what person in, say, a legislator's office, is the legislative assistant going to be working on it? Is there IT resources needed? And we identify particular people and what their pay rate is, and then we compute an hourly pay rate for each of them and their estimate of the amount of time it's going to take, and add all that together, and that's the source of the fee. It's very time-consuming because you have to identify particular people involved. This policy will simplify that greatly. It's modeled after the Department of Administrative Services policy, and it basically lumps fees into three categories: clerical work at $25 per hour, work that requires some expertise in terms of legislative operations or the legislative process at $40 per hour, and then professional level work, which would be legislative counsel or information services, at $75 per hour. It would vastly facilitate how the fees are calculated. And then, for the first time, it incorporates standards by which fees may be waived. And this, again, is similar to what the executive branch does. There is a 40% fee reduction. If four standards are met, the request is unrelated to any commercial or political. This isn't in DAS, but we're proposing that it might be considered here. If the request is for political opposition research, if the request is not paid by, if the requester is, if the request is not going to be paid by some third party, but as actually the person who's requesting, so if they have the resources to hire a law firm to do this, then perhaps there isn't a fee waiver isn't warranted. If the request is unrelated to any existing legal or administrative proceeding, and if it is in the public interest. If all of those four standards are met, then there is a 60% reduction, or the next paragraph lays out a 100% reduction if the request is narrowly targeted to specific information, and all of the information is in the public interest. Finally, there is a de minimis exception for fees that are less than, where the request is less than $25. That is existing practice as well. So that proposal is also something to that we're asking for your consideration at a later date. And then we have just 2 minutes, so I will highlight two other kind of problem areas with how the legislature handles public records, and it's somewhat a challenge, an appearance challenge. And these typically arises when there are requests made of multiple members, and members choose to do different things, and that makes it appear that the legislature is acting inconsistently. And so one thing you might consider would be is if one member wants to claim the in-session exemption, request made of all members, that the in-session exemption applies. Otherwise, it does appear some do and some don't, and it appears to be inconsistent. And Finally, and this is again to deal with the shortened time frames. If there is, again, with requests of multiple members, if one wants to claim a different kind of exemption, and there's a lot of sometimes difficulty in communicating from the Legislative Council staff and the member, the exemption is available. Do you want to claim it? And there's a lot of days often missed in trying to get confirmation that no, they don't want to claim it, or yes, they do. And so this would expedite that process.
So I'm not going to have a discussion now. There is a Legislative Administration Committee meeting starting at 1:30, and many of us are on that as well. So I do thank you for your opening remarks, as you've indicated. We will be taking these up in the near future for the Legislative Council Committee. Anything further anyone wishes to say at this moment? I will adjourn the Joint Committee on Legislative Council. Thank you for coming.